Good afternoon, everyone. I am Hank Jones, sitting in for Andrew Herod on this Friday, May 20th, 2022. Normally, you would hear Andrew Herod today for Conservative Casual Friday, and it would usually be around noon Eastern time. Andrew is traveling this weekend, so he is not able to sit in, so I am sitting in for him, grateful for the chance to do so. Blog Talk Radio, of course, is the medium. The network is Global Patriot Radio, and we've got something going every day here at blogtalkradio.com. Mondays, Vito Esposito Show, featuring Vito and Big Al. That goes at 6 o'clock Eastern Time. Every Tuesday, you've got Eric with the Cross and Crescent Dialogue or Discussion. That's also at 6 o'clock. Wednesdays, it's normally me, Hank Jones, at 5:30 p.m. with Hank Jones Poly Sports. And then Thursdays, Paul Sutliff is in at 6 p.m. Eastern with the Sutliffian Report. Fridays, Andrew Herod brings you this show, Conservative Casual Friday. He usually goes around 12 noon Eastern time, sometimes a little bit later, sometimes even earlier. But again, those are things where you have to check out the showrunners and look at our schedule. Saturday nights at 10 p.m., Minister Usama Dakduk, along with the beautiful Christy, revealing the truth about Islam. And then Sundays, Eric returns with Real Interfaith Dialogue at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's it. 7 days a week, 7 shows a week. More than 7 hosts, because on some you get co-hosts or dual hosts. There are other shows also on Blog Talk Radio. Fridays, I think, Airwaves America with Dave and G-Ski Rocks. Tim Tapp, I think, is on Fridays. He might be on after this later on, as well as Dave and G-Ski. Annie with Southern Sense Radio is usually on multiple days, and she... along with Tim Tapp, they do simulcast of their shows on certain networks, as does Eric and as does Saturday Night Show with Usama and Christy, and others might as well, where they'll simulcast on YouTube or on local radio, just depending. Another guy I listen to, Joseph Gibson, has a good show called Understanding the Times in Which We Live. Chief with the Simple Facts of Life. Chief goes, I think, on Tuesdays. And maybe other days as well. So a lot of good stuff here on blogtalkradio.com. A lot of good stuff here at Global Patriot Radio. To reach me anytime, hey, hjpsports1980@gmail.com. You can find me on Twitter at hpolysports. Andrew is on Twitter as well. I think it's at A.E. Herod. In fact, you should be able to find all of us on Twitter, just listening and what we tell you. Let's see. Operating again via remote Hankland. We are in Ohio. My wife's mother, my mother-in-law, is having some health challenges. My wife is helping out, and I am. It's good intent, but I'm not the best helper. But I am along as well. This week's obits, 2 losses Wednesday. First, singer-songwriter Bob Neuwirth. He co-wrote the song Mercedes-Benz with Janis Joplin and Michael McClure. That became a hit for Janis Joplin, of course. He also introduced Janis Joplin to Kris Kristofferson, who wrote a song that he let Janis perform. It became a mega hit after she passed away. It was called Me and Bobby McGee. Yeah. Everyone's heard that one. We also lost Larry Lacewell at age 85. Larry Lacewell was a former college football player. Then he had a long career in the coaching ranks. Actually won 2 Southland Conference championships as the head coach at Arkansas State. And yesterday we got the news that the last surviving daughter of the Von Trapp family, Rosemarie Trapp, passed away last Friday at a nursing home in Morrisville, Vermont, at the age of 93. She was actually not portrayed in The Sound of Music. That was the film about their life in Australia before they fled the country when Nazi Germany took under Hitler seized control. The movie featured the 7 children of Baron Georg von Trapp, his first wife. And then Rosemarie was the daughter of Georg and his second wife, the would-be nun Maria, played in the film by Julie Andrews. She's survived by one brother, Johann von Trapp, who is the last surviving member of the original Family Singers. By the way, there were several areas under which the film took license. Georg and Maria had actually been married about 11 years before the events of the film, and the family fled to train by Italy, or by train to Italy. It wasn't an overnight hike through the Alps to Switzerland. Actually, it really is a great film, nonetheless. One question that I have, though, if you're getting married to a woman, whether she's a wannabe nun or whatever, but especially if she's a wannabe nun, and she marches down the aisle with all the other nuns singing, "How do you solve a problem like," whatever her name is, aren't you maybe a bit skittish? I mean, what the hell? I can't imagine wanting to marry a problematic wannabe nun. But, you know, maybe that's just me. Who knows? I missed this one, but I saw back on May 11th, Randy Weaver died at age 74. Randy Weaver, if you remember, was the survivalist who, after failing to appear for a court date, came under FBI siege at his property in Idaho called Ruby Ridge. In that siege, Randy Weaver's 14-year-old son, Sammy, was shot in the back by FBI thugs as he was retreating from the initial encounter. And Randy Weaver's wife, Vicky, was later shot while holding their 10-month-old daughter. He eventually surrendered and was acquitted by a jury of all charges, except for the initial failure to appear charge. So Randy Weaver gone at 74. Let's get to the news. Notes or idiocy or whatever. Some interesting things. As if teachers and library people and whatnot running drag shows wasn't enough, we get this little story from The Blaze. Yeah, woke Arizona high school counselor who helped organize drag show for students is arrested and accused of having sex with a 15-year-old girl. Former high school counselor who previously helped students organize a drag show was arrested and accused of having sex with a 15-year-old girl, according to police. The Tucson Police Department's Child Sexual Assault Unit received a report of an inappropriate relationship. Zobella Brazil Vinick, age 29, and a 15-year-old student at Tucson High Magnet School. At the time, Vinick was a counselor at Tucson High Magnet School. Authorities launched an investigation into the claims on May 3rd. On May 4th, detectives from the Tucson Police Department Sexual Assault Unit informed the administration of the school of an ongoing investigation into one of its counselors. Read a statement from the Tucson Unified School District Superintendent, Dr. Gabriel Trujillo. The administration was informed of an alleged inappropriate relationship between the counselor and a 15-year-old student from Tucson High. On May 5th, the school district put Vinick on administrative leave and initiated its own investigation. On the same day, Vinick resigned from her counselor position and is no longer an employee of the Tucson Unified School District. On May 11th, Vinick turned herself into the police for the alleged charges of an inappropriate sexual relationship that occurred off campus. Vinick was charged with one count of sexual conduct with a minor into the Pima County Jail. One station reported Vinick's ex-wife told law enforcement officials that the couple had been allowing the 15-year-old to live with them in their home. She reported that the 29-year-old and the 15-year-old have been co-sleeping together, and she recently found Vinick's underwear hidden under a pillow on the bed that the student had been sleeping in. Police also seized cell phones via a search warrant, which, quote, revealed inappropriate messages between the two that supports a sexual/romantic relationship. The interim complaint stated that the female victim confirmed she had a sexual relationship with the high school counselor and that the relationship turned sexual around February of 2022. So up to 3 months before this got discovered. Police said during the investigation, detectives found probable cause to arrest the counselor. Previously, Zobella oversaw the high school's Q Space after school program. The high school defines the Q Space Club as, quote, a space students will learn about LGBTQIA plus history, create community, and engage in individual and group work, exploring identity and collaborating to discover community care and joy. So Bella was reportedly involved in organizing the first ever student drag show at Tucson High Magnet School that was scheduled for May 7th. The counselors created an Instagram page for the drag show, which followed one other account, THMS Counseling, which followed the account in return along with the THMS Yearbook account. Counselors also invited students to access a, quote, drag inquiry form, unquote, using their Microsoft Office student account, according to a report from the Arizona Free Press that was published in March. Instagram post reads, are you ready to see an epic drag show? We're ready too. Q Space's first ever drag show at Tucson High will be on Saturday, May 7th from 5 to 7 p.m. In anticipation, we'd love for you to meet some of our fabulous student performers. Counselor was previously a community advocate. What is it? Appears that her very woke profile on the Scholarship A to Z site has been scrubbed. However, an archived version states that the counselor, former counselor, majored in peace and justice studies with a minor in Latinx or Latinx studies at Tufts University. While in college, she, quote, co-organized a campaign to make Tufts University accessible for undocumented students, unquote. So Bella's preferred pronouns are she, her, ella. Ella is she in Spanish, or her, I don't remember which. Yeah, I'm not even sure. You know, I'll go along with the fact that 15 isn't the same as 10 or 6 or whatever, but there's no way that a 29-year-old counselor or teacher or whatever doesn't know that being, I mean, I would assume, well, that's just it. Maybe we shouldn't assume that schools have this in their policy. Maybe we shouldn't assume that schools outline this. I mean, who knows? Maybe it's not even against policy. I don't know. I do not want to make that assumption anymore. But I can't believe a 29-year-old hasn't had it ingrained in some sense that having a relationship with a student, if not against policy, is just flat out wrong. This is from Conservative Review, per Daniel Horowitz. States must act or will need to act to preempt WHO pandemic regulations. Okay. On March 21st, back on March 21st, Dopey Joe said, and now is a time when things are shifting. There's going to be a new world order out there, and we've got to lead it. And we've got to unite the rest of the free world in doing it. Now, Daniel Horowitz says any Republican running for any office this year, without mentioning his intent to fight the global pandemic treaty or regulations, may as well run as a Democrat. In the past, odious global agreements threatened our national sovereignty. This one will quite literally abrogate our individual sovereignty as human beings and make us all lab rats in the hands of wicked global elite oligarchs. On May 22nd, the World Health Assembly, the governing body of the World Health Organization, will meet in Geneva, Switzerland to discuss the next step in its nefarious pandemic treaty and the quest to use public health to expand the WHO's power over sovereign states. Representatives from 193 nations, including the U.S., will be attending. Interestingly, the only country not invited is Taiwan. Of course, China requested that they not be allowed. So what is the nature of this pandemic treaty agenda? It's a priority, according to Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, Director General of the WHO. It's a priority, quote, to urgently strengthen WHO as the leading and directing authority on global health at the center of the global health architecture. He laid out the guiding principle. We all want a world in which science triumphs over misinformation, solidarity triumphs over division, and equity is a reality, not an aspiration. He concluded, we are one world, we have one health, we are one WHO. Now, Daniel Horowitz noted, until now, La Dopi Nostra has been very quiet about this. Unlike they have been about international climate treaties or others. But however, it came to light several months ago, La Dopi Nostra quietly sent the WHO several amendments to a 2005 international health regulation to be considered at the May 22nd meeting. At the time, the White House never issued an official statement or held a press conference. The draft was not made public until mid-April. What is the nature of these amendments? They would essentially allow the Director General of the WHO to declare a public health emergency in a country and unilaterally coerce its citizens to take certain actions. The proposed amendment deletes a critical sentence from Article 9, 2005 regulations, which says WHO shall consult with an attempt to obtain verification from the state party in whose territory the event is allegedly occurring. Now, what could be the reason for the Biden administration erasing an existing requirement? It says if the state party does not accept the offer of collaboration within 48 hours, WHO shall, when justified by the magnitude of the public health risk, immediately share with other states' parties the information available to it, whilst encouraging the state party to accept the offer of collaboration by WHO. In other words, Biden administration, La Dopi Nostra, wants all emergency declarations to be mandatory and cut out all views of the concerned state. The amendments are also designed to truncate the period of time for approving this. Currently, WHO regulations provide for an 18-month grace period during which a nation may withdraw its yes vote for the amendments. La Dopi Nostra would truncate that to just 6 months. Now, talks about unknown causes, which, as Horowitz points out, could literally mean anything under the sun. Fact here, as he points out, is that rather than publicly supporting a new pandemic treaty, La Dopi Nostra is trying to use the global momentum for such a treaty to strengthen existing regulations the U.S. already signed on to. They'll never get 67 votes in the Senate to ratify this, so they're trying an end run by strengthening the existing agreement that the Senate did ratify. Here's what Horowitz says. Horowitz says it's very simple. Every Republican running for state or local office must pledge to pass a resolution preemptively declaring these regulations null and void. Only something ratified by 67 senators has the force of law. Any international hocus-pocus is dead on arrival. Notice how the Biden administration just held a, quote, global COVID summit in which they all unanimously warned about the really bad pandemic this fall that will be worse than what we experienced. Basically, they're grooming us to accept a concentration camp created by local government, global governments. You know, it's time to get this out, and it's crucial that we vote conservatives in. But what he's saying is state legislatures must be ready to convene and prohibit and even criminalize the implementation of any international standard. Yeah, that's, isn't that uplifting? The idea that we've got a WHO that is trying to, more along that line. Guess what? Not only does Anthony Fauci milk us for hundreds of thousands of dollars each year, plus who knows what else, but his wife does too. And guess what? She wrote a paper for companies letting them know it's okay to pressure employees and to embarrass vaccine resistors. Seriously, she did. It's from the National Pulse. Bioethics chief happens to be Fauci's wife. She published a new paper telling corporations they can ethically pressure employees and embarrass resistors. Now, this is good. Now, Fauci's wife is also, she's the head of the Department of Bioethics at the National Institute of Health Clinical Center. The study she did, it's called The Ethics of Encouraging Employees to Get the COVID-19 Vaccination, was funded by the National Institutes of Health Clinical Center and the National Human Genome Research Institute. Her name is Christine Grady. She's one of the authors. She's not the only. Published in March 2022, it followed attempts by the White House as well as Democrat politicians across America to mandate COVID-19 vaccination for federal and state workers. Her paper focuses on the ethics of encouragement strategies aimed at overcoming vaccine reluctance, which can be due to resistance, hesitance, misinformation, or inertia to facilitate voluntary employee vaccination. You realize when you do this that it's not voluntary. I hope she understands that. She had three co-authors, and they outlined how it's ethically acceptable to, quote, subtly pressure employees to get vaccinated. While discussing mandates, the paper posits they can, quote, be ethically appropriate if there is, quote, clear articulation about the consequences of not complying with the policy. In that circumstance, employees have a choice between getting vaccinated or accepting the consequences of a choice to remain unvaccinated. Outlines other tactics employers could use, such as sharing targeted statistics for competition or even implicitly embarrass vaccine resistors. There can be social consequences associated with peer communication about vaccination, such as stigma and ostracization of those not vaccinated. Think about this for a second. Think about this. This is a group, one of the things that they talk about, whether it's the National Institute of Health, the CDC, it doesn't really matter, or Big Left in general, they always talk about bullying. You know, they always say, I mean, when they defend a leftist who goes in and fires up a school with a gun, and it's obviously not a conservative, it's a leftist, they say, well, this was bullying. It was obvious bullying. So here they say there can be social consequences associated with peer communication about vaccination, such as stigma and ostracization of those not vaccinated. Are you kidding me? There's no higher form of bullying. I mean, that is one of the pillars of Nazism, authoritarianism. Says individuals who choose to make the workplace less safe for others through their vaccine refusal should be able to foresee the possibility of this kind of social consequence. And it says when a policy is tied to group vaccination metrics, unvaccinated employees may feel implicit or explicit pressure from peers or supervisors to help the group meet its return to work goals. Here's a couple other highlights. Here's one. While employment-based vaccine encouragement may raise privacy and autonomy concerns, and though some employers might hesitate to encourage employees to get vaccinated, our analysis suggests ethically acceptable ways to inform, encourage, strongly encourage, incentivize, and even subtly pressure to get vaccinated. Here's another nice juicy tidbit. Despite worries about a perception of unfairness, we argue that the selective easing of public health restrictions is ethically appropriate when done transparently and tied to objective public health guidance. What? Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Hey, T. Bodie's in the chat room. T. Bodie's in the chat room. Folks, if you're listening and you want to call in as well, there's a number to call, 319-527-6706. I forgot about that one because I wasn't sure, frankly, who might call in, but it's good to see T. Bodie in here. He obviously got my text and my notice about the special show. Okay, how about this whackpot testifying in Congress on what is a woman and whether or not men can get pregnant and have abortions. Cute stuff, huh? Anyway, this woman goes by the name of Ms. Amy Arambide. She was asked by Representative of Congress, I think his name was Dan Bishop, asked her to define a woman. She gave a doozy, that's for sure. She said, well, really, anyone can identify or self-identify as a woman. So she wouldn't answer, what is a woman? She just said, well, anyone can self-identify. When he asked her, however, do you believe then that men can become pregnant and have abortions? She topped it. She sort of did a slow, kind of like you could see the wheels turning, like, are the folks from Big Left watching this? She just, a very slow, yes. I mean, she wasn't even quite 100% sure, but it was like, yes. How do you answer that? How do you come back from that? I mean, hey, it sure sounds like NPR is a great place to work, or not. Per a story from The Blaze, NPR is urging employees to encourage fellow employees not wearing masks to follow the publicly funded broadcaster's mask guidelines. Failing that, they can notify a supervisor. And if all else fails, the natural course of action is to report it to their snitch line. I mean, hotline. Yeah, their hotline. Which, of course, may result in termination of employment for the offender. Does anyone aside from me not find all this hypocritical? I mean, it's publicly funded, so they say they can require you to wear a mask. They can require you to be tolerant. God forbid they have to be nonpartisan or require normal people to be tolerant, but not provide for those same normal people to be tolerated. I know much of this is in reaction to the, quote, sudden resurgence in COVID cases. Guess what? According to the CDC, exactly 6% of all COVID deaths are, quote, solely from the virus. In other words, 94% had some other comorbidity, 94%. Is it not convenient that we are coming off winter, you know, when we were told that was the prime time for the virus? But with the primaries for the midterm election starting, we are suddenly seeing a resurgence. By the way, I did air quotes for resurgence because I no longer believe the numbers, except for one very telling relational aspect. Supposedly, cases are up nationwide compared to a year ago, but deaths are way down from a year ago. In other words, they can't allow for the idea that COVID is no longer a weapon for tyranny. Now we have, of course, monkeypox with supposedly two whole cases in the U.S. coming on the scene. Yeah. So here, who here thinks that we might see more election scumbaggery complete with drop boxes, paid ballot harvesters, and even more paid ballot box stuffers? I'll tell you what, folks. These people are desperate. They will not quit. That's kind of why it's important not just to vote, but not just to get your friends and family to vote. It's also important to hold elections offices, local elections offices accountable. Be vigilant for signs of election fraud. I mean, poll numbers be damned. These people will not take this gracefully, even with poll numbers showing an almost certain GOP dominance in November. You know, coupled with possible Supreme Court rulings, Big Left is frantic. And that's when they are most dangerous. That's when the Big Left is definitely most dangerous, when they get into frantic mode. Okay. Some gun control lunacy. Got a couple items here. First, in spite of Big Left blaming the GOP, Carlson, or conservatives for the Buffalo grocery store murders, the shooter's own statements and web postings and diary point to the opposite. Although a racist and anti-Semite, the shooter claims to be left-leaning, professed hatred and contempt for the GOP, and made zero mention of Tucker Carlson, or any other prominent conservatives for that matter. Commentators and influencers from Big Left later said disinformation was the culprit in the early reports. Yeah, that would be funny, if not for the fact that, per most of Big Left, disinformation is the exclusive domain of the GOP and conservatives and conservative commentators. Look, these people are sick. They completely ignore what has been discovered in the shooter's diary, such as direct citations from websites and from forums and various subgroups on Reddit and 4chan and other places. They willfully ignore his disdain for the GOP, while at the same time highlighting his racist and his anti-Semitic entries. And they blatantly ignore the fact that this guy was visiting websites and forums related to mass killings and mass murderers. By the way, why is it when this happens? Well, anyway, yeah, but yeah, it's Tucker Carlson's fault. And according to some clown named Rashad Robinson, Trump is part of it too. Do these people have no shame? Seriously, do they have no shame? Do they possess no integrity? Most importantly, perhaps, do these people have any grounding in reality or truth? Seriously, why is it after these things, after these acts, do we find out, one, that the FBI was aware of something 6 months ago or 18 months ago or whatever, but why do we have such quick access to this information? Why is that? Gee, you'd almost think it's... I don't know, arranged. Okay, as I said, I'm currently in Ohio. As my mother-in-law is going through some health challenges, and I said, so my wife, with my well-intentioned but rather meager assistance, she's here to help her through some of the initial stages of transition from a completely independent lifestyle to one that will require various types and levels of assistance. So it is kind of ironic that this next item pops up while I'm here in Ohio. Congressional Black Caucus Chair, Representative Joyce Beatty, an Ohio Democrat, is blaming white supremacy and a white supremacist replacement theorist for a shooting at a Korean hair salon in Dallas last week. Representative Beatty addressed folks at a press conference outside the U.S. House yesterday, which included, by the way, the attendance of Plastic Pelosi, a.k.a. the poster child for what apparently happens when one ingests vodka at warp speed. At that conference, Beatty piped in with this. On Monday, three people in a Korean-owned hair salon in Dallas were by yet another white supremacy replacement theorist. And then she added, we are sick of the pipeline from racist rhetoric to racist violence. First of all, the shooting happened 5 days earlier. It happened on May 11th, last Wednesday, a week ago Wednesday. Second of all, though, it actually is being investigated as a hate crime. It just wasn't a white supremacist that perpetrated the act. It was a black gentleman who, for whatever reason, has panic attacks and delusions, again, air quotes around delusions, when he is around people of Asian descent. Apparently, he was in an auto accident 2 years ago that involved an Asian male. He was also previously fired from his job at an Ulta beauty warehouse after attacking his Asian boss. I don't make this stuff up, folks. What the hell? Do these people do no research, no elementary search for the facts, and do they feel no responsibility for being truthful? And for God's sake, if you're going to go all anti-gun, why do you then blow the narrative by lying about most of the facts of the event in the first place? Actually, I can answer that last one. First, the suspect used a .22 rifle, and yes, it can still kill. A .22 rifle fired at any appreciable distance becomes rapidly less effective as that distance increases. Now, I know, somebody's going to say, Hank, the mob uses .22 pistols for a lot of their wet work. Yeah. A .22 rifle is rimfire versus centerfire, thus it has much less power and impact. And a .22 pistol used for wet work will be like real up close and personal, not spray and scatter fired indiscriminately. Second, due to the facts of the above, it sort of blows open the gun control narrative due to the fact that .22 rimfires are almost universally viewed as harmless, are not seen in an automatic version, and are largely viewed as target and training weapons, which brings us to number three, the word universal. Damn near any kid born before 1985 has shot or at least had access to a .22 rimfire. Places where shooting was done as part of school classes, like PE classes, scouting groups, hunter safety courses, etc., all of those would have used .22 rimfires. That, by the way, includes the little lefties, whose parents probably just gave them expensive quasi-grown-up versions of them, gave them to their darling little aristocrats for plinking at cans and trees and squirrels on the old family estates up there in New England. This would include, by the way, John Kerry, who served in Vietnam before he evolved into a goose hunter. And, yeah, just as you would expect, remember he did that goose hunting photo op when there was no active open goose hunting season in that location? Yeah, per the usual, they probably figured big media would have no idea of that. Frankly, I'd bet the Kerry campaign had no idea. But anyway, even little John Kerry and probably all the little Kennedys had .22 rimfires at their disposal. We did as kids. Hell, Joe Kennedy was in cahoots with some of those mob types and their .22 pistols. Yeah, but so in addition to just being stupid and ignoring the facts, Representative Beatty also obliterated any chance at saving face with a gun control swerve. And finally, on the anti-gun front comes this item from Newsmax TV, where Dwayne Dog the Bounty Hunter Chapman told the network yesterday that gun owners should have a mental health card before being allowed to have a gun. Yeah, as you can expect, I am going to verbally blast this idiot to kingdom come. To start, on an appearance on Newsmax TV's show Eric Bowling, The Balance, Dog said that gun owners should have, quote, a mental health card from a doctor that says you have to qualify to be able to own a gun, unquote, as well as saying anyone arrested with a gun without the serial number should be punished for 5 years. Now, here's the short form article from Newsmax, which will be followed by my obliteration. So here's it. American TV personality Dwayne Dog the Bounty Hunter Chapman told Newsmax on Thursday that gun owners should have a mental health card from a doctor that says you have to qualify to be able to own a gun, and that a person arrested with a gun sans serial number should be punished for 5 years. Dog goes on to say, the Biden administration is trying to pass laws about not possessing guns in parks or not possessing guns at a theater house. That is not going to stop anything, Chapman said during an appearance on Eric Bowling the Balance. His comments come days after 10 people were killed at a Buffalo supermarket in a predominantly black neighborhood by a lone gunman suspect who previously released a racist screed that suggested he had targeted African Americans. Dog goes on, just because some people have been shot in a park or at a supermarket, to have a law to say you can't have one there didn't work in the first place. Here's my idea after some 40 years of experience. You need a mental health card from a doctor that says you qualify to be able to own a gun, Chapman said. You have to have a mental evaluation, believe this or not, to be a psychologist. You have to have a mental evaluation to be a police officer, a fireman. There are so many jobs in America where you have to have a mental evaluation. 12 states have laws banning ghost guns or homemade weapons that have no serial numbers, and are therefore untraceable. Chapman also suggested the punishment for having a gun should be longer. Okay, so they're going to buy hot guns without serial numbers? They are going to be punished for 5 years, he told Newsmax. A trio of senators on Wednesday introduced legislation that would require residents to acquire a Department of Justice license before purchase or obtaining a legal firearm. The bill, heavily opposed by Republicans, would also raise the legal age for obtaining a firearm to 21 years old. Okay, dog, here's the scoop. Defending oneself or being part of the defending this country is a right granted under the Constitution, under the Second Amendment in the Bill of Rights. No mental evaluation is required, you know, just like no mental evaluation is required under the rest of the amendments in the Bill of Rights. Guess what else, dog? Who cares if there are jobs that require a mental evaluation? And I would admit some of those you listed are part of an overall testing protocol, not specifically geared to evaluating mental fitness, as it were. But I digress. Just because it's required for certain jobs, nobody is forced to become a psychologist, a police officer, or fireman. By the way, what a sexist pig. There are many female firefighters, dog. Either way, it's one's personal choice. And those jobs also involve interacting with people in potentially dangerous environments and scenarios. I would guess any mental evaluation for such isn't about owning a firearm. It's about being able to do the actual job. Okay, dog, next up. What the hell with the serial numbers? Why do you deliberately conflate a potentially illegal firearm with a constitutional God-given right? Next up, dog. Like most morons who overreact to each and every firearm-involved crime, you are confusing criminals with law-abiding citizens. You lump them together, and then you assign them the same quote-unquote rights. Thus, of course, you make lawful gun owners subject to punishment for the misdeeds of actual criminals. In what world does that make sense? I mean, other than in kindergarten, where the kid who threw rocks at recess got the whole class punishment. Come to think of it, it didn't make sense then, and it doesn't make sense now. He says, you don't make sense, dog. Dog, do you realize you actually indirectly impose a tax, a very burdensome and unfair tax, on the most vulnerable when you do this? As an example, take the young single parent struggling to make ends meet, does the best that they can, especially in today's economy. They're going to have the burden of having to do a doctor visit, probably a copay. Maybe not. May not even be covered by insurance, which, by the way, that single parent may or may not have. You think wealthy folks won't have an advantage? And so how does that single parent, who may live in an in or near an unsafe area, how do they protect his or her family? Probably takes several paychecks, maybe months worth, to save out enough money for decent protection. Now, cost of a doctor visit, probably quote-unquote the license that may result. Yeah, you think Barbara Streisand's bodyguard has that problem? Yeah, think again, dog. Hey, dog, what about an evaluation for things covered under the First Amendment? Frankly, I wouldn't mind the Reverend Jesse Jackson submitting to a test before he's allowed to preach on Sunday. And I really wouldn't mind Thomas Friedman or Chris Wallace or Rachel Maddow undergoing some serious, rigorous testing. All honesty, I'm not sure any of them would pass any objective mental health exam. Frankly, dog, I'm sure you'd trip the buzzer a few times. But hey, freedom of speech, right? Come to think of it, why are mobsters or IRS commissioners or FBI agents allowed to exercise the Fifth Amendment protection for self-incrimination? Dog, you really think Lois Lerner was anywhere close to quote-unquote qualified to know whether or not she would incriminate herself? Don't answer that. You'll just incriminate yourself. By your twisted definition, gun crime is only committed by people not mentally qualified. Hell, according to your warped thinking, further onerous regulation will suddenly fix something that criminals already have no intent to observe in the first place. You as much as said that. There are already laws that they don't obey. So you're penalizing, of course, the law-abiding. In your idiotic mindset, Further erosion of rights leads to better security? That is a thought process that only an imbecile could love. Imbecile follows that line of reasoning and thinks, yeah, that'll work. Dog. God, why? I mean, how do these people get on these shows? Why do they give them credence? Why does that happen? What made someone think that having Dog on a show would be good and that he would be... Ugh. I really don't get it. I really don't. Now, let's take a quick break and we'll come back and get to the sports side of things.
Stop wasting my time. You know what I want. You know what I need. Oh, maybe you don't. Do I have to come right flat out and tell you everything? Give me some money.
Hank Jones sitting in for Andrew Herod on this conservative casual Friday. And it is Friday, May the 20th, 2022. And I am still in for Andrew because Andrew is traveling this weekend. So let's get to some sports stuff. But first, let's give you the signals. If you want to call in, 319-527-6706. And, you know, hit the one. I get this little icon, and I can hear that, hey, this person wants to talk. This person wants to talk. So, anyway, let's get to the sports. So, the PGA is going on in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Began yesterday. As expected, Rory McIlroy and Justin Thomas are at the top or near the top of the leaderboard. I'll give you a mild surprise. John Daly is at plus two. He shot even par 70 today. He'll all but for certain make the cut and be playing this weekend. Now, Tiger went off. Remember, he got a bet on 60-1 odds. He shot 4 over 74 yesterday. He was an obvious pain in the latter part of his round. My guess is that pending what McIlroy and others do this afternoon, Tiger needs to shoot no worse than even par today, probably 1 or 2 under, to play Saturday and Sunday. But hey, at least he's there, and along with John Daly could really make for some interesting and entertaining viewing this weekend. Let's quick check. Let's just see where they are right now. Justin Thomas at still at 6 under, Zalatoris at 5 under. Wow, I'm not sure where McIlroy is. McIlroy was under at 4 under or 5 under the first day, but I'm not seeing him there. Let me pull up the scores, see what's happened to him, because he's not showing at the top of the leaderboard. Yeah, he's dropped a couple strokes. He is 2 over today, so he's at 3 under right now for the tournament, so he needs to kick it up a notch as well. So, hey, it would be nice, though, to see Tiger and John Daly playing this weekend. It really would be. NBA conference finals are underway. In the East, the Celtics evened it up, beating the Heat last night, beating the Miami Heat. Got a road win, brings that series to 1 game each. In the West, the Dallas Mavericks will try and steal a road win at Golden State tonight, try and even up that series. Celtics were boosted really by the returns of center Al Horford, and especially point guard Marcus Smart. Smart played 40 minutes, 24 points, 12 assists, 9 rebounds, 3 steals and a block. Yeah, that's a pretty nice return. And if he can stay healthy, that bodes well for the Celtics. In my opinion, the Heat are too dependent on Jimmy Butler and thus are pretty one-dimensional. Even with his 29-point performance last night, Butler's plus-minus on the night was a minus 20. Yeah, so. Hey, did any of you realize that the CFL, the Canadian Football League, was on strike? Yeah, me neither. But what I did notice when I went to their site yesterday is that the strike was the first one the league had in almost 40 years. Yeah, who knew? Basically, this will be the first on-time league start since 2019. The new agreement between the league and the players makes that possible. The strike lasted about 4 days, which damn near makes it a no-harm, no-foul kind of strike. The only reschedule, which is minor, is the opening preseason game between the Saskatchewan Rough Riders and Winnipeg Blue Bombers. That was set for this Monday. It's going to be bounced back a couple days. The deal updates like revenue sharing, player health and safety, salary cap increases, guaranteed contracts. And also, it lowers the, quote, Canadian content aspect of each team's roster. You know how, like, there's a Canadian content law for, like, broadcasting and other stuff? The CFL has one, too. Previously, each team was required to have at least 21 Canadian players on its roster with a requirement that 7 of them must be starters. I know, messed up. It still requires 7 Canadian starters, but allows a provision that longer-term non-Canadian players, i.e. Americans, can be utilized as Canadian players, or I guess you could say are exempted, as long as they have at least 5 years in the league or 3 years with their current team. Anyway, the Edmonton Elks, they used to be the Edmonton Eskimos, but political correctness. They released former Iowa Hawkeye Tavon Smith. Now, he had a good career at Iowa, of course. Several short stints in the NFL with the Colts and the Raiders and the Jags before he joined the Eskimos, which then became the Elks. Now, he had signed a one-year extension back on January 20th. And he is considered a national or a Canadian player. That's what they call him, national, having been born in Toronto before he went to prep school in Connecticut. And, of course, his four-year career with the Hawkeyes. No Hawkeye fan will ever forget this.
Play fake. Beathard sets up deep in the pocket. Goes down the field for Smith. Oh, he got it! Smith! Touchdown, 85 yards! Iowa! C.J. Beathard!
Anybody mind if I play that again? I just love that. Gus Johnson.
Play fake. Beathard sets up deep in the pocket. Goes down the field for Smith.
Oh, he got it! Smith! Touchdown, 85 yards! Iowa! C.J. Beathard!
That was so cool. It didn't end well, but at least, it was that shining moment. Hawks took the lead in the Big Ten championship game that year, 2015. But, yeah, I assume he'll catch on somewhere else, but just tough to hear. Trans sports, they've added the world of skateboarding to their invasion. This from Conservative Review. Female skateboarder speaking out. Female skateboarder Taylor Silverman is speaking out about losing to a biological male. In an Instagram post, Silverman said that she placed second in a Red Bull competition and lost out on prize money because of a transgender competitor. Silverman placed second in the Red Bull Cornerstone competition last year. Here was her Instagram post. My name is Taylor. No, this is, I think, an email or a letter she sent to Red Bull. My name is Taylor Silverman. I am a female athlete. I have been skateboarding for 11 years and competing for several years. I have been in three different contests with trans women, two of which I placed second. At the last contest series I did for Red Bull, I placed second. The trans competitor who won took $1,000 in qualifiers, $3,000 in finals, and $1,000 in best trick. This totaled to $5,000 of the prize money meant for the female athletes. I took $1,000 in qualifiers and $1,750 for second place, so $2,750 in total. The girl who took third received $750. I mean, this is unbelievable. The girl who deserved $1,000 for best trick took nothing, along with whoever would have placed third. I deserved to place first, be acknowledged for my win, and get paid. I reached out to Red Bull and was ignored. I am sick of being bullied into silence. She then posted an email. This is her Instagram. She then posted the email that she sent to Red Bull, but she noted that she has not received a reply. She says, I am reaching out in hopes of being directed to the right person to express my concerns about what occurred at the Red Bull Cornerstone contest with a transgender competitor in the women's division. A biological man with a clear advantage won the women's division, best trick, and also won multiple qualifiers. This took away the opportunity that was meant for women to place and earn money. What happened was unfair, and at the time I was too uncomfortable to speak up. I understand that in today's society, even some women think this is acceptable, but I believe in doing the right thing, even if it's not the popular thing. I now realize it's really more important for me to speak up, and I'd like to schedule a time to talk. While some on Instagram agreed with her sentiments, others promoted radical leftist gender ideology and decried Silverman for her comments. Good for you for speaking up, Taylor. I support you. Please try to keep in mind that the internet is not an accurate snapshot of reality, so the abuse you're getting here is not the voice of those around you. The vast majority of people, even in the most liberal areas, agree with what you're saying here. I'm sorry you're getting abuse for saying so, one person wrote. Another person wrote, trans women are women. The real issue here is you not seeing that. The skater who won qualified and won fair and square. The reasoning you have here is very transphobic. No, it's not. It's very pro-women. It's not transphobic. It's pro-women. Why are we continually seeing this? And what in hell does someone not understand about the inequities here? At what point is someone going to step forward, cite Title IX, not to mention basic biology, and just end this? I mean, look, a person has a right to be trans. That's fine. But that right doesn't necessarily extend to sports or, frankly, to anything else. I mean, you have trans people wanting to use both bathrooms. And I've seen about it and heard about it from family members, including my wife, at various times in her career. You have trans people pretending to be women but really compete against women as men. It's not difficult. It's really not. Why are we allowing this continue? Folks, this next item, get to your local warehouse club. Pick up the gargantuan-sized promotional container of pop-it-yourself popcorn, as big a tub of butter as they sell. Yeah, while you're at it, stop by the beer aisle and grab 24 of your faves. The verbal feud right now between Alabama head coach Nick Saban and Texas A&M head coach Jimbo Fisher should live up to everything we would want in an intra-Kardashian feud. Basically, here's how it went down. I'm going to read Nick's original statement, or some of Nick's original statement. Basically, I'm going to read some snippets from each of these. Saban singled out Texas A&M for buying its top-ranked signing class. He says, I mean, we were second in recruiting last year. A&M was first. A&M bought every player on their team, made a deal for name, image, likeness. We didn't buy one player, all right? But I don't know if we're going to be able to sustain that in the future because more and more people are doing it. It's tough. He said Alabama players made $3 million doing it the right way last year, and that only 25 players were able to leverage NIL opportunities. Really? So 25 players with NIL opportunities. Let's think about that. Let's get out the calculator. 25 million, or I'm sorry, 3 million. Gosh, come on, Hank. 3 million divided by 25. It's 120 grand per player. Doing it the right way indeed, huh? He isn't the first coach to call out A&M. February Ole Miss coach Lane Kiffin said Texas A&M was going to incur a luxury tax in how much they paid for their signing class. he said Jimbo Fisher said they were spreading rumors and they're a bunch of clowns and they're irresponsible as hell. Saban said the problem is coaches trying to create an advantage for themselves. Duh. So that was good. Here's Jimbo Fisher's reply. You're going to like this. It's Jimbo Fisher. It was a press conference, and he lit into Nick Saban. So let's hear this. Jimbo Fisher delivered a fiery rebuttal to Alabama football coach Nick Saban's comments from Wednesday night that Texas A&M, quote-unquote, bought every player in its vaunted 2022 recruiting class, calling Saban's comments despicable. Times in a 9.5-minute news conference. He was visibly angry. He says, "We never bought anybody. No rules are broken. Nothing was done wrong. It's a shame that you've got to sit here and defend 17-year-old kids and families in Texas A&M because we do things right. We're always going to do things right. We're always going to be here. We're doing a heck of a job." And he didn't name Saban, but his response was similarly personal. He says, "It's despicable that a reputable head coach can come out and say this when he doesn't get his way," Fisher said. "The narcissist in him doesn't allow those things to happen. It's ridiculous when he's not on top." Texas A&M signed 5 5-star prospects in the 2022 ESPN 300, 20 of them ranked in the top 150. It is widely considered the top-rated group in the modern era of recruiting rankings. Fisher, who served as Saban's offensive coordinator and quarterbacks coach at LSU from 2000 to 2004, cast accusations of his own against Saban. "Some people think they're God. Go dig into how God did his deal. You may find out a lot of things you don't want to know. We build him up to be the czar of football. Go dig into his past or anybody that's ever coached with him. You can find out anything you want to find out, what he does and how he does it. It's despicable." And Saban, of course, said Alabama players made $3 million doing it the right way. "I mean, we were second in recruiting last year," and we talked about that. So Saban also singled out Jackson State in his comments, saying the school paid Travis Hunter, who was a 5-star prospect who flipped from Florida State, they paid him $1 million to join the program. Deion Sanders, their coach, denied the rumor. Fisher then added, "What's funny, in that talk right before he said that about us, wasn't he soliciting funds from the crowd? It's amazing, isn't it? When you walk on water, I guess it doesn't matter." Saban, for his part, said, "Look, I never should have singled out anybody, and I wasn't saying that either of those schools did anything wrong. I didn't intend it to mean they were buying players, but more that you're able to buy players now and it's totally legal. You're just using name, image, and likeness to do it. What I'm saying is that it's not good for the game, and it's only going to get some worse unless there's some federal legislation." Fisher said Saban had called him, but he hasn't answered. "Not going to. We're done." He was contrasting his time with Saban and his time as an assistant at Florida State under Bobby Bowden before he took over as the coach there. Said, "He's the greatest ever, huh? When you've got all the advantages, it's easy. You coach with people like Bobby Bowden and learn how to do things. You coach with other people and learn how not to do things. There's a reason people I ain't back and worked for, Nick Saban, don't want to be associated with him. You can call me anything you want to call me. You can't call me a cheat. I don't cheat and I don't lie. I learned that when I was a kid. If you did, your old man slapped you upside the head. Maybe somebody should have slapped him." Whew. Now, A&M Athletic Director Ross Bjork said, we're being accused of using NIL to induce players, which is against the NCAA rules, which is against Texas state law. So that's why we're so defensive. It's because we're not being accused of having – because we're being accused of having all of our players on our roster having NIL, which is all permissible. It's, oh, there's only one reason why they're doing this. That's the part where Jimbo is emotional and personal because he knows how hard he works, how hard the staff works, how great of a place A&M is. Greg Sankey, the SEC commissioner, issued, by the way, public reprimands of Fisher. T-Bodie, the skater's name is Taylor Silverman. T-Bodie's asking who the skater is. His sons are skaters as well. At the Des Moines Park, which is the largest in the country. Yeah, Des Moines, Iowa. Her name is Taylor Silverman, T-Bodie. Anyway, as I said, Nick Saban countered with his piece. He said he shouldn't have singled out those schools. He laments that he did that. He says it's completely, but NIL is completely out of control and it's not a sustainable model. It's still to the point where you've got these attorneys and agents calling collectives and saying, pay my player $100,000 a year. And then they want their piece of that. They all want a cut. As I just noted though, Nick Saban's guys who did it right averaged $120,000 per. But he says it's on him. He should have clarified how he meant bought. He says, I don't want to go down that road of bidding for players out of high school. Folks, Nick Saban's been doing that already. And if it's not him, it's his boosters. So that whole thing is just a crock. Now, Deion Sanders, as I said, did respond. He says, I haven't talked to Coach Saban. I'm sure he's tried to call. We need to talk publicly, not privately. What he said was public. That doesn't require a conversation. Let's talk publicly and let everybody hear the conversation. You can't do that publicly and call privately. No, you can't. I still love him. I admire him. I respect him. He's the magna cum laude of college football, and that's what it's going to be because he's earned that. But he took a left when he should have stayed right. I'm sure he'll get back on course. I ain't tripping. That's Deion. He's also done several Aflac commercials with Saban. He also issued a warning, he said. He says, I don't even wear a watch, and I don't know what time it is. They forget I know who's been bringing the bag and dropping it off. I know this stuff. I'm not the one you want to play with when it comes to all this stuff. Don't want him to know, talking about what he knows when it comes to this. He mentioned, though, this is to local, Saban was speaking to local business leaders in Birmingham, and he didn't name the player. But he talked about a guy named Travis Hunter, who's ranked number 2 on the ESPN list, flipped from Florida State to Jackson State. He says Jackson State paid a guy $1 million last year. That was a really good Division I player to come to school. It was in the paper. They bragged about it. Nobody did anything about it. Sanders dismissed the notion of Hunter earning anywhere close to $1 million. He goes, I don't make it $1 million. Travis isn't built like that. Travis ain't chasing a dollar. Travis is chasing greatness. Travis and his family don't get down like that. They never came to us in search of the bag. They're not built like that. This kid wants to be great. He wants my hands on him. He wants me to mold him. He wants me to be his navigational system through life. He wants to be that dude. Hunter is the first 5-star player to sign with an FCS school. He idolized Deion as a kid. His father rooted for the San Francisco 49ers, which is how he became a Sanders fan. By the way, they also signed Kevin Coleman, 7th-ranked wideout in the ESPN 300. Deion said, once upon a time, the bag was just a bag. Now there's equality among the big boys. We don't have those types of bags. We don't have the boosters and donors and givers. Leave me out of that mess you all got going on. So, yeah, Deion made the point. He says, he wasn't talking to me. He wasn't talking to Jimbo Fisher. He was talking to his boosters. He was talking to his alumni. He was talking to his givers. He was trying to get money. That's what he was doing. He was just using us to get where he was trying to get to. Very good point from Deion on that. Very good point. That's exactly what Nick Saban was doing. He was saying, we can't win. Now, the ESPN staffers weighed in on this. I've tried to walk into a little bit and then read some of it. It's very difficult. It really boils down to this. Okay, let's try and whittle this down. Okay, here's what this is about. First, maybe the best example of how out of control this has gotten came yesterday or the day before with the official announcement from Pitt wide receiver Jordan Addison that he is indeed transferring to USC. Remember, USC went 4-8 last year, but this year they hired former Oklahoma head coach Lincoln Riley. Riley absolutely poached the crap out of Oklahoma's roster, not to mention raiding other rosters. So USC is now apparently the hot new college football destination again. Anyway, like I said, that just points up the problem. Now, I've been talking about NIL for a couple years. Look, while we all knew it was coming, I'm pretty sure nobody expected this. And the problem is it also happened shortly after the lifting of transfer restrictions, which gave us the transfer portal. What Nick Saban is saying is that schools, via boosters in most cases, but not always, are using NIL as a recruiting tool with an unlimited salary cap. And some folks have noted another thing, in fact. How is the $300,000 a year young assistant coach going to feel when they welcome that $500,000 a year freshman who hasn't even played a down of college football? Frankly, how's a senior going to feel about it? How are guys going to feel about it at USC? They've been there for three seasons, and this transfer comes in, and he's getting this huge NIL deal. And while it's a separate argument in terms of the tampering comes into play with the NIL coupled with the transfer portal with a free transfer. But especially, though, Jordan Addison kept talking about Pittsburgh, that's my brotherhood. I'm not going to talk down about him. Well, why would you? Now, supposedly the NCAA is weighing in with the statement that even with a name, image, likeness, boosters are not allowed to recruit, induce, or reward athletes for choosing a given school. And while like NIL collectives are an apparent attempt to circumvent that, the NCAA is saying that individual or corporate, it doesn't matter. Rules about boosters still apply, even with NIL. The questions are, one, how do you stop it or rein it in? And two, how do you stop or reverse some of the deals we now have in place? So here's my five-point plan. This is just my five-point plan. NIL should be limited to players and companies. No school involvement, none. No NIL department, no NIL coordinator, nobody in the school working on behalf of NIL. A school gets a call from T. Bodie Chevrolet in Iowa City. Hey, we want to – no, sorry, can't come through us. Can't even tell you, you know. Call information if you want his number. The player or a representative is the sole contact or negotiator. You know, report income to the IRS, report deals to the conference of the NCAA so it's on file. I think that's fair enough. But you got to report the deal. I mean, as an example, you don't want a bunch of kids who are signing NIL deals with gambling, like online gambling sites. Now, I know that online gambling is legal, but you know what? You don't want that even that appearance. So schools and conferences, et cetera, they've got to know about these deals, but they shouldn't be involved in them. Two, I would say NIL deals are not allowed for 1 year if a player is transferring and wants immediate eligibility. Now, look at it this way. If ABC Corporation offers my son Hank Jr. X dollars to transfer from Iowa to Illinois, he can choose this. He can take the NIL deal, but he's got to sit a year. Or he can play immediately, but he gets no NIL deal. He's ostensibly doing this not about football. He's doing it, or basketball. He's doing this about academics as well. So he gets one or the other, not both. Look, there has to be a limit to free agency. And if colleges want to institute it, they should be allowed to do it in ways like this. I'm pretty sure no corporate entity will give a deal to a kid who's going to sit a year, just as I'm sure a kid is not going to go with no guarantee if he doesn't have NIL for a year. or he's not going to go to take NIL and sit for a year. And third one, allow schools to reduce scholarships for those who have NIL deals. Why not? If a kid's really getting $300K from an NIL deal, he can take a reduction in his scholarship. He can fork over some of that money for his education. Non-athletes do that. Non-athletes take out student loans. So, yeah, a kid getting a huge NIL deal, schools should be allowed to do that. Why not allow the school to lower the amount of the scholarship? Why not? Four, I would say coaches who do get caught engaging in NIL on behalf of players, banned for life. If they truly care about, quote, student athletes, they'll allow them the majority to negotiate their own. And frankly, it keeps coaches and boosters separate, as it should be. I'm not talking about that summer, you know, Gator Club booster lunch or the Aggie Club booster dinner. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about during the season and during recruiting, coaches and boosters should have no contact. Any coach that's really wanting to be a coach would observe that anyway. And number five, I would do this. Apply strict observance to laws, whether it's tax laws, Title IX regulations, any other applicable statutes. Look, a player or school breaking the law or NCAA rules is an offender. It's as simple as that. A school caught breaking those laws, yeah, why not face prosecution at the local, state, or federal level? Not some toothless bureaucracy like the NCAA has become. Seriously, why not? If a school gets caught, what's with it? Why an investigation? T. Bodie notes some stuff. Of the big linemen who don't get the big NIL deals, I mean, he's right. They'll squash those that do. Teams will fail. Universities will lobby to eliminate it. It may take time to play out. But you know what? There's really even no need to eliminate it. I mean, you can't have NIL and then limit it. You know, you can't have NIL and then say it's got to be capped at this. That doesn't work. I mean, you can't. I mean, the same people that say that doesn't work. I mean, I'm not in favor of capping a CEO's salary. Why should I be in favor of capping a kid's salary? I don't care if he's only 18. Don't tell me that he's not mature enough. If he's good enough to get an NIL deal, let him. Let him pay for his college then, too. And let there be rules. I mean, you know, there's no free agency where a guy can just leave. And free agency comes with limitations in pro sports. If a guy's under a 5-year contract, he doesn't just quit the Cubs and go play for the White Sox. He can't do that. Well, why should they be allowed to do it in college? I mean, you're telling guys that are 30 years old who have put in their time in the pros, you're not telling them they've got to abide by their contract, but you're telling 18 and 19 and 20-year-olds they don't have to? I mean, they sign a national letter of intent for one thing. So how fair is it to allow them suddenly, one, in schools, I mean, recruiting. You know, it really makes a difference in the recruiting level. And I mean that by this. You know, a coach now has to, you know, and people are talking about this. A coach has got is recruiting on two fronts. He's recruiting his incoming players that he wants. He's recruiting the players that he already has. You know, there should be limits to transferring. I mean, guys that are transferring three times, I know students do it too, and we allow that. But students also aren't being compensated for their football. They're usually paying for it or they're taking student loans or whatever. You don't see a kid who goes to MIT on an engineering scholarship suddenly transfer to Georgia Tech or wherever because they outbid him for his, you know. They don't do that. So there's got to be some limits in the sports realm part of it. That's pretty simple. It's not hard to do. But, I mean, by the same token, let them have why not allow them to have their way of making it? I get that. But what we have right now, free transfer, getting the free transfer, tying it to NIL. Now, some of this is because of some of the COVID stuff. You've got guys that probably would normally have lost eligibility that are getting that extra year because of COVID. That's playing into it. I mean, some of these guys have had their degree for a year, 2 years, and they're doing these little, they're doing these things to remain eligible. That's complicated as well. But from a recruiting standpoint, it's not just unfair to the coach. It's unfair to the kid that's already at this school. The kid that's already the quarterback at Oklahoma who thinks he has a shot now, and suddenly they bring in a transfer or two, and they give him NIL deals, wink, wink, behind the scenes to get the kid to come. How fair is that to the kid that's been working hard? Now, granted, it doesn't mean he doesn't have a chance to win the job, but they're already sort of telling him he doesn't have a chance to win the job. But it's not just unfair to the schools and the coaches. It's unfair to some of the players. There are some other dirty little secrets. There are people, numbers of people, thousands of people in the transfer portal who have not landed anywhere else, have not gotten scholarship offers elsewhere. Now, when you announce that you're in the transfer portal, you can go one of a couple ways. You can say, I'm just putting my name in, coach. I'm still here. And the coach can say, okay, cool. You're still here. You're playing. They don't have to. They can limit they still keep their academic scholarship, but the coach can limit them, can limit their access, can take them off the team, take them, withdraw training table, meaning, training meals. They can withdraw that if they want, just like the player can leave if he wants, he or she wants. May not be smart, but that's allowed. So there are some things. Guess what? Kids are going to find out. So not everybody's cut out to get that big offer at the next school. Some leave because of playing time. Well, guess what? You're going to face playing time dilemma anywhere you go. I don't care who you are. You still got to earn your spot on the team. So, by the way, T. Bodie likes my rules. I mean, not all of them probably, but, we've got to have something here. We've got to get this worked in. I'm not sure how, but it's got to get done. Okay, some final notes. Big Al sent out a tweet, said, thank the Wuhan virus for allowing us to see what schools are teaching our children. Absolutely. So spot on. It's unbelievable. Here's one. I've talked about this before. The kindergarten curriculum in Seattle during COVID, they were opening each morning at school with acknowledging that we are here on stolen land. They went even further. You didn't steal it. We know that, but we are here on stolen land. That's messed up, but at least we know that that's what's done now. Here's another one. I have a friend who's a retired teacher, retired in the last couple of years, and he cited this example. You have a student named Jim, let's just say, or let's call him Hank. You have a student named Hank. Hank decides he wants to be called Irene. And Hank identifies now as a girl named Irene. So Hank has to refer to her by her pronouns. So the teacher's got to refer to that person by their preferred pronouns, their preferred gender, they, them, he, she, whatever, he, him, her, she, I don't know all that. So they have to do that. They have to, they can get punished by not doing that, by calling them by their given name. They can get punished by not referring to them as their preferred gender. Except, here's the big thing, except when their parents are at the school, doesn't want their parents to know, you must refer to them by their given name and their original gender. So you want to tell me these people aren't trying to indoctrinate and that these people aren't trying to groom? Hell yes, they are. When I heard that, I mean, that brought it home. I mean, he said the stuff of people going to, you've had boys wanting to go in the girls' bathroom for years. That's nothing new. Now you've just given them a way to pretend that they're a girl and to go in. And we had, of course, the kid in Virginia, that's two different sexual assaults. But no, here's a situation where you've got to call Hank Irene and refer to Hank as a girl, he, she, they, them, or whatever. But when Hank's parents come for open house night or whatever, if Hank's not comfortable, you got to call him Hank. You got to refer to him as him. in front of the parents. So you got to be part of that lie. You got to be part of that lie for school policy. That's how messed up it's getting, folks. That's how messed up it has gotten. Hey, thanks everyone for was here. I saw a couple numbers on the thing, and T. Bodie in the chat room. I know it was short notice. I just sent out last night on Twitter, and I just sent out today to those on my text. So I know it's 4 o'clock on a Friday Easter time. I know a lot of people can't get to get together then on quick notice. Thanks, Al and others for asking me to sit in. Andrew, I hope you're doing okay. I hope your travels are going well. I will be back next Wednesday at 5:30 with Hank Jones Poly Sports. Andrew will be back here next week, either noon Eastern time or a time that he so chooses. So come on back then. You've just only had to put up with me for this one day. In the meantime, folks, have a good weekend. Be safe out there. Good luck to those in the PGA. Remember, the Preakness goes off tomorrow. And, hey, oh, you know, I wanted to play this little thing. This is when I was talking about the Saban stuff. This is how I feel when I see this, when I hear this stuff going on. This is how I feel.
Oh, boy, is this great!
That's what I'm thinking when I think of Nick Saban and Jimbo Fisher and all these people getting together and fighting it out and arguing back and forth. It's just so perfect. It just is so perfect. And hopefully it gets better for the rest of us. And, of course, I'm going to leave on this final note because I just love playing this. I'm playing it again for T. Bodie because I think he missed it when I played it before. He said, here we go.
Play fake. Beathard sets up deep in the pocket. Goes down the field for Smith.
The greatest couple minutes. T. Bodie also pointed out, and I'll say, just like on Gutfeld last night, he says, if we are going to be lambasted for the failures of our forefathers, then we need to be credited for their successes, too. Landing on the moon, the transistor, those kinds of things. So if we're going to be told that we're here on stolen land or whatever, then we also need to remember that we liberated slaves. You know, we made it possible for women to do this, some of the things they've done. They don't do it in all other societies. So enough of my ranting. Andrew's back next week, and y'all have a good weekend, folks. Be safe.